returning to some of the fundamentals of our practice periodically. Today and in the next few weeks, we'll do that by focusing on the first three foundations of mindfulness. This was really invited by several of the people overseeing the whole curriculum for Marin Sangha, and seeing the value of having some actual content covering some of the very central and traditional material. And so the theme today is mindfulness of the body. And I would make the claim that mindfulness of the body is both the first foundation of mindfulness, and it's the crucial foundation for bringing mindfulness into the flow of daily life, particularly in a very mental and increasingly virtual culture. That the training to be mindful of the body has a very, very central and significant role. And so my hope today is to speak some, give some encouragement for the practice of mindfulness of the body, invite the devoted practice of mindfulness of the body for the next week. And I have the handout that gives a number of different ways of practicing mindfulness of the body that we can follow, with the main ones being mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of being in a given posture, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, and then mindfulness during various activities. Now, one of the ways we can listen to a talk on mindfulness of the body is, guess what? By having some mindfulness of the body. So see if you can stay with some awareness of the body even as you listen. Even as you listen to the talk, it might be just to feel the hands together. Can you do that and listen? Maybe if some of you have practiced further, it could be to listen and be with your whole body. Or maybe just the feet on the floor or the contact of the cushion. Just keep some relationship to that during our session. And I also will cultivate mindfulness of the body as I speak. When I was first starting to give talks, I was being mentored by John Travis. And John gave me this guidance for giving talks. This was after, you know, after I had done, well, I'd probably done over 20 years of practice at that point. And John said, be with your body, be present to your body, be present to your heart, and let your thoughts self-organize. Which was good guidance for me. And so that's my practice right now, as we're all hopefully cultivating mindfulness of the body. So just a few words of review of what we call mindfulness, sati, S-A-T-I in the original language, that the Buddha is often taken as having as his distinctive offering to the world the cultivation of mindfulness and insight, and the resultant insight from mindfulness. He himself understood what he was teaching as the revealing of an ancient path, as a kind of rediscovery of an ancient path. And if you look at the core text in the Pali Suttas about mindfulness, mindfulness has a very central role. He says, mindfulness is the direct path for the purification of beings. That's pretty strong language. Mindfulness is the direct path for the purification of beings, basically for the ending of dukkha, usually translated as suffering. For the attainment of the true way, the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. So mindfulness makes possible transformation, the transformation of our being. And we'll explore different ways that that occurs, a few of the different ways. And it ultimately, we could say, even our very simple mindfulness of the breath followed continually connects us with the mysterious nature of awareness. It opens up to, we could say, to a vast liberating awareness. Not always in an obvious way, but it has that power. It starts opening up our being. That's a very precious quality. Not always appreciated in its depth as mindfulness becomes popular in our culture. I was just reading today an older New York Times article about the introduction of mindfulness into the military. And it's been brought into all these other areas. Mindfulness has a few different capacities. It has the capacity of staying with what is there directly in our experience. So mindfulness has the capacity of being stably with something and not losing it. Another way to say that is mindfulness, to be effective, has a certain degree of steadiness, or depends on a certain degree of steadiness in the mind, because it depends on a certain level of concentration. So we can actually stay with and not get lost from what's right there in our experience. And one of the commentaries, I think from one of the Abhidhamma commentaries, it says, mindfulness does not wobble. Wobble is one of these esoteric Buddhist technical terms. So mindfulness doesn't wobble. Mindfulness guards our experience in a way. I think that Achan Chah once said that mindfulness is like a protector. It's like a net that catches unskillful thoughts and tendencies of mind and protects us. And then in the old text, the mindfulness is seen as a protector. It's that way that when we know what's happening, we're less likely to get caught. When we know that there's reactivity or anger or frustration or blaming, and we're mindful of that, that's the key to not being stuck in those states. So it has the qualities of protecting. And mindfulness is also very linked to wisdom, that when we're mindful, when we're aware of our experience moment to moment, and this is what we do in meditation, we see our experience, especially we start seeing patterns. We see, oh, when that mind state occurs, when I have that thought of what happened 2 days ago, I go into this narrative, which connects me with resentment, which I then solidify by repeating the narrative for the next 20 minutes. And so mindfulness is directly connected with the wisdom of seeing what's there so that we can respond skillfully. So again, mindfulness is has a quality of directness, of being with experience in a more direct way, relatively free of interpretations, present-centered rather than in the past or future. Has a quality also of openness. Mindfulness can be with whatever is there. And in our practice, we typically bring in a very open, even what we call choiceless mindfulness that just is there with whatever is predominant. So mindfulness, in a sense, doesn't care what is being experienced. It can be with anything. So I like to think of mindfulness as really having, as occurring maybe in three main ways. The first is simply to know what is occurring. We know there is anger, or there is that storyline, or contentment, whatever. So first we know what's there, very crucial. And this is the most fundamental aspect of mindfulness. And you can do this during the day, just to track what's there. Again, it doesn't resolve things necessarily, but it's a starting point. The second is, when something lasts for a while, we can explore a given territory with mindfulness. If I'm reactive, and I know that, and I can be mindful, I can study my own experience. This is one of the great fruits of our mindfulness practice. I'm reactive, I'm going into a storyline, I can be with my body. Be mindful of the body, and often see what is driving the reactivity. Mindfulness can, again, protect us from being stuck in a particular fixed state for a period of time. So we can use mindfulness really to explore experience. What's it like in the body? What's the emotional energy like right now? What's the narrative? So we can use a little bit of thinking to guide us, but we're essentially being directed with the experience. And then thirdly, mindfulness can see patterns. We can notice this led to this, which is really close to one of the core Buddhist teachings or teachings of the Buddha called dependent origination, which in its most general framing is because of this, this occurs. So we see our own personal patterns and we start to see larger patterns. We start to see when I have an unpleasant experience, I tend to go into pushing it away. And we can study that. We can study that and see those patterns. So the Buddha gave four foundations of mindfulness. I like to think of them as the first three, which we'll cover, having to do with the main constituents of experience. And so the first foundation is mindfulness of the body. Second foundation is mindfulness of feeling tone, vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And the third is called mindfulness of citta, C-I-T-T-A, which is really, I more or less say, mindfulness of thoughts and emotions, even though those terms aren't there in the old text. They divide up experience by what we would call mind, considered broadly in body. So there's actually no word for emotion in the Pali text that translates easily as emotion. What we see in the translations, and it's called mind, really for us it would be better to say mind and emotion. Yeah, because it includes anger, fear, you know, as well as our stories and narratives and so forth. So in the Pali text on mindfulness of the body, there are four ways of being mindful of the body. And these are, first, mindfulness of breathing. Secondly, mindfulness of these four postures. Mindfulness when we're sitting or standing or walking or lying down. The third is mindfulness during activities. And then the fourth, fifth, and sixth are not commonly taught in most places. The fourth is mindfulness of the 32 parts of the body. And the practice is taught by some teachers on that. The Venerable Analayo has taught on that, and Bob Stahl teaches at Spirit Rock, teaches on that typically once a year, based in Santa Cruz. But that's not taught so much. And also related to that is an emphasis that must have been designed for the more monastic practitioners of considering the unpleasant qualities of the body, sometimes called the foulness of the body. This has not been a practice taught widely in the West. Okay. And then the fifth practice is the practice of seeing the body as the four elements. This is taught some, but this is taught where we consider the way that we can see the body as very much like other bodies in the natural world, as having qualities like water, like fire, like earth, like air. The solidity being like earth, the various aspects of water, the saliva and so forth being like the water, air through the breath and so forth, the lungs, and the sense of the fire related to heat and the heat and energy of the body. And then the last of the six is the contemplation of decaying bodies in charnel grounds. This has not also been widely taught in the West. But we could probably broaden that more and see its importance of having to do with understanding the impermanence of the body and being aware of the reality of death. So I want to come back to the first three of those, which are really our core practices. But first I want to just frame this a little bit, in our own cultural context and say that mindfulness of the body in our cultural context is revolutionary and really, really crucial. That we live in a culture in which we often, typically maybe, distinguish mind from body and emotions. And for a number of people, the conditioning is to be primarily living in a mental realm. And there are gender manifestations of this. That's a little more the case for men than for women, but with all the increase in electronic devices, this is very widespread. This way that we live in an increasingly mental world. And this has been going on for some time, right? At the 1600s, 1700s, there was the rise of a thinking independent from religious dogma, and the rise of science, and Descartes says in the mid-17th century, I think, therefore I am, that the thinking is the most important thing. And, you know, with the culture, reason and rationality become the most precious things. And this is essentially what we're taught in schools, right? How many of us were taught to be mindful or aware of the body? Or of emotions. You know, so one of the current revolutions is to have emotional intelligence. You know, and there was an emphasis often on physical culture, right? On sports and activities. And this was a part of my learning, right? But it didn't involve awareness of the body. It involved activity. And so I've sometimes told my own personal story of being very physically active, but having almost no awareness of my body. And maybe that was the case for many of us. Like I say, there are gender dimensions to this with, you know, which I think have changed some, but, you know, at an earlier period of time, it was thought that men were more, capable of being just with thinking, and that emotions were the place for women to be. And probably we all got some of that conditioning, right? And even now, I think 75% of psychotherapists who listen especially to emotions are women. That's not a coincidence, right? And where I sometimes give the quote from former President Bush II, where after 9/11 he was asked, "What have been your feelings these last weeks?" And he said, "I don't do feelings. That's Laura's business." Yeah, it's painful. But that reflects that conditioning very directly, right? And so that was my conditioning. And I've told the story of thinking I'm just found myself walking thinking all the time, that I was like consciousness on a pole, right? Again, physically very active, not aware of my body, right? And so, for me personally, developing mindfulness of the body has been central almost from the beginning of my practice. It was maybe like for you, it was a revelation at first. Oh, I can be in a way in which I'm not simply with my thinking all the time. I can be with the sunset and actually be with my senses, which is a reflection of the body. I can walk and feel my body. Gosh, never done that before. You know, and it was revelatory and powerful, and opened up also, again, what I was calling earlier, the subtle body energies. You know, my first retreat, just to give a sense of the subtle energy bodies that are available. Wasn't known before that. Like a mystery of, again, unfortunately not really taught much in Theravada tradition. Interestingly, I've been interested in why that is. Taught more in some of the yogic traditions, in Tibetan tradition, Qigong and so forth. It's a little bit of a footnote, but opening to that, just the mysterious nature of the body, which opens up when one meditates a lot, especially on retreats, and having a sense of that was a radical change in my own experience. And how many can relate to that in some way? Yeah, that was the case. And for me, there have been different phases of practicing with the body. I think that, like I say, that was the emphasis almost right at the beginning, to ground in the body. But still, I had that some, especially when I was meditating. I remember a friend of mine saying, it was after about 12 or 13 years of practice, it was a good friend who was not afraid of being direct with me. She said, "Donald, you're not really very aware of your body, are you?" And I huffed and puffed some. But I thought that there was truth to that, and so I wanted to deepen that. And I went through another deepening about 20 years ago when I did a lot of work with John Travis, who was really a wonderful teacher of the body and body awareness. And I did about 4 years of very intensive practice where mindfulness in various ways of the body was my main practice for 4 years. And the initial practice, I had mindfulness of the whole body, the practice we did at the end. I did that for about 2 years all the time. So I would be on retreat and I would do that all day long, just mindfulness of the body. And over that time, what happened was that awareness of the body from doing it that much got burned into consciousness. And so in daily life, it became always accessible. I could always go to awareness of the body, the whole body. And it was a way of staying present in activities, in talking, and so forth. And so that was a core practice. I did a lot of other practices. Some of them more involved the energy body. I remember doing practices which were very helpful to develop something that's developed in some of the martial arts, to develop a center. So I did another year of focusing my attention on my belly, which is really crucial to, you know, as a way of centering. Again, this is not part of the traditional instructions, but it's just to say that this was very crucial and became central in bringing awareness to activities during the day. Without access to mindfulness of the body, mindfulness during the day is going to be really, really hard. And so it's of tremendous importance for bringing our practice in daily life. And in its more developed qualities, which again has been an emphasis for me, one can have mindfulness of the body as the central capacity that makes possible mindfulness in thinking and talking and even doing email. Possible. The most accessible probably is mindfulness in listening and talking. So how many of you have been able to be mindful of your body some as you listen? Right? Easier in listening than in talking. You know, hard, you know, relatively harder for me if I'm speaking, but done it enough so it's actually not hard. You know, it's just there. Right? And that can be that's a capacity. So, the foundation, the first three ways of being mindful of the body, I'll talk about that, and again, I have the handout so that you can work with some of the practices next week that seem most helpful to you. So, mindfulness of breathing as a first practice. And again, we can be mindful of breathing in various ways. We can be mindful of breathing at the nostrils or at the area of the lungs, at the belly, the whole body. People do it in different ways. We just want to find where it's easiest to follow. And then the use of the labels can be really, really helpful. And I've especially found it useful to have the label for the pause, which is when a lot of people lose attention of the breath, lose attention, the attention goes away. And again, for many of us, mindfulness of breathing is a real ground and way to develop mindfulness of body. This was my first practice, which again was revelatory. Gosh, I can be with the breath. I'm not thinking all the time. Hallelujah, to give a Buddhist quotation. Okay. And so we can stay with the breath, and of course we can develop that mindfulness of breathing to a very high degree as it's done in concentration practice. We can keep with mindfulness of breathing until we have tremendous steadiness. And so mindfulness of breathing can be done as a concentration practice. It can also be done primarily as a mindfulness practice where we may notice the changes, notice the different patterns. Because one of the emphases that we see in the mindfulness of the body text is that there is a way that we not only develop mindfulness, but we also develop wisdom. And this occurs, especially in the way the Buddha taught, by noticing how things change, how if we are reactive, we suffer, and we notice that nothing really is independent and lasting. And so I would say, especially for our practice, we can tune into one of these core wisdom dimensions. Those are the three areas of liberating insight. And this is what all of the teachings point to. Be insightful about impermanence. Be insightful about dukkha, or reactivity. Be insightful about the construction of the sense of self. Be aware of all three of those. Here, in our practice, I would especially emphasize the first. When you're with the breathing, you can do it in two ways. As a concentration practice, we're with the breath and just really staying with it and trying to latch onto it. As a mindfulness practice, we're more with the changing flow of the breath. And we just stay with the changes. We notice the changes. And we stay steady with the flow of the breath. Okay? So we can use the mindfulness of breathing at times in the flow of daily life to bring us back if we've got a little bit off center, if we're a little bit in distress or troubled, the mind's going in different places. You can just right on the spot be with the mindfulness of breathing. Really, really helpful. Can really just bring one back. Very good practice to do right before going to sleep. That if you can really stay steady with the breath, it helps wonderfully to have a good sleep. I know that maybe this is your experience, like when I'm on retreat and I go to sleep with mindfulness of breathing, it can be with some depth from the retreat experience, it can be there in a way in which there is almost no thinking before going to sleep. And then if I ever wake up in the middle of the night, I go right to the mindfulness of breathing, and there are just no thoughts, and so there's like almost no possibility of being kept up by thoughts, which is very nice. And I also found it also helps me, I do this at home, but also especially in retreats, I like to be aware of my dreams, and so it's very common, like on retreat, for me just to wake up at the end of a dream cycle, write down the dream, and then at the end of it, go back to mindfulness of breathing and just go right back to sleep. And sometimes on retreats, I wake up noticing dreams as many as 10 or 12 times a night. Remember 10 or 12 dreams, which is very interesting. Yeah. The content, that's another matter. I think we've never had a session on dreams here, have we? We should do that.
Okay.
Because it's, how many of you would like that?
Yeah.
Okay. I love it. The theme, and there's a lot there. Okay, so the second of the practices is mindfulness of the four postures. And again, this can be done right now. This could be done at a meeting. You could just be aware of the body when you're in a given posture. Particularly, the easiest way to cultivate this is when you're maybe at a meeting, or don't have to do much thinking, or don't have to be so active on your own. Maybe you're just waiting for someone, go right into mindfulness of the posture. Waiting for public transportation, just waiting can work with one of the postures. You can do this, again, before sleeping. Be mindful of the body lying down. Be mindful of the body when you wake up. Just go to mindfulness of postures. This is the second area of practice of mindfulness of the body. And then the third is mindfulness of different activities. And this is where we try to keep mindfulness of the body and in various activities. It could be walking, right? Of course, we can do walking meditation. One way to really keep the mindfulness of the body practices going is to do walking meditation every day. It's very helpful before sitting. You could also, I did this practice for a long time, I would take after a meal, I would take a 10-minute walk and do mindfulness of the body. Some of us, you know, have routines where we can do that, or some of us go to work and we have a certain amount of walking. Do mindfulness of the body. When I was first meditating, I was a student living in Boston, didn't have a car, a lot of walking, maybe an hour of walking a day, a lot of public transportation. I was complaining about not enough time for meditation. And I just had a brilliant insight. Let's just take all my walking as mindfulness of the body. Right? You can do that. Right? A lot of the secret of having our practice come alive is finding activities during the day in which you're not adding anything to your to-do list, but you're just taking something you're already doing and bringing mindfulness to it. That's one of the secrets to deepening practice. It's a major secret. Not secret anymore. Okay. So we can work with mindfulness in certain activities. Again, you might want to take a given activity. Mindfulness when you're washing dishes. Okay? You can do that, or brushing the teeth, or taking a shower. I remember Sylvia Borstein said taking a shower was one of her main mindfulness activities. Yeah, so she doesn't think, because it's very pleasurable, right? For most people, warmth, you know, and so forth. And so she said she didn't want to lose those moments. So she just said mindfulness. So we can just see a given activity that can work for you. And again, sometimes it can be mindfulness of the whole body. For some activities, like if you're at a meeting or waiting, maybe the mindfulness whole body is too hard. You can cultivate it, but you can do mindfulness just of feeling your feet on the ground or the hands together. So again, what's the reason for doing this? It's to be cultivating mindfulness that supports mindfulness when it's really crucial, such as when we're in distress or when we want to listen carefully or want to be very present for a friend or when we're meditating. And so the more we cultivate mindfulness, the more it's there. You know, the aim that we have from the text is to more and more be mindful more and more of the day. Very clear. Right? So maybe just to close, then we can have some time for a discussion. A few things to close. I'm going to encourage you to choose one or two ways of being mindful during the next week, mindful of the body. It could be mindfulness of breathing during the sitting. It could be saying, this activity, I'll be mindful. Right? Maybe consider right now, how do you want to cultivate mindfulness of the body in this next week? Just reflect on your own. And again, the handout has a number of possibilities listed. And try to remember each morning your intention. Because we say often, mindfulness isn't so hard. Remembering to be mindful, very hard. Okay. So let me close with maybe two readings. First is from Achan Man. He said, in your investigation, never allow the mind to desert the body for anywhere else. Stay grounded in the body. And then the second is guidance that I got actually from John Travis. We were talking And I was complaining. I was saying, I don't have as much support in my daily life for mindfulness as I would like. Those people, like monks or nuns, those people who live in monasteries or live in centers, they have a lot of support. Or when I'm on retreat, a lot of support. Blah, 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 you know. I don't have enough support. My practice isn't going to be as good or as deep. And then John said, let your body be your monastery. Meaning, body's always there. Let your awareness of your body be that which is your major support, which continually brings you back. And when I heard that, it was like electric. Whoa, whoa. And it stayed with me. Yeah, I think that's truth. In our culture, let your body be your wake-up call. Let your body be what you stay with. Again, a lot of different ways to practice. We just want to find what works for ourselves. Okay, so thank you for your kind attention. How many people stayed more or less with their bodies? I did. I think I was losing a little bit at the end. But back. So we have some time for questions, reflections, comments. Good. And I can repeat them. Yeah. Yeah, let's use, yeah, great, we can use the mic.
Thank you, Donald. That was really helpful. I think as we age, or I should speak for myself, as I age, body parts give me a really good place to stay with the body. The different aches and pains and injuries make me very aware of the body. But I have a question.
Yeah.
In practicing the Metta Sutta, it says whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. So whenever I notice myself standing or walking, seated or lying down, if I notice that I'm in that position, I start the Metta Sutta in my head. So now I have that dilemma that I've had throughout learning so much about Buddhist practice. I don't know when to stay with mindfulness of the body and when to go to the Metta practice.
Well, if you're doing Metta all the time, don't worry about it. So the question is about having an association with the postures and Metta practice. And I think the question is, from your own discernment, would it be helpful to develop more mindfulness of the body?
That I seem to do most during activities.
Yeah.
Whereas in the four postures, I tend to go to
I see. Yeah, I mean, if during the four postures, which covers a good amount of our life, like most of it, if you're staying with metta, I mean, you can also do both at the same time. You know, the way I like to teach metta is to have it be embodied. You know, so you're in your heart, but you're also in your body, right? So you could, one way you could work with this, I think two ways. One, the first is, see if you can have your metta be yet more embodied. Bring more of a sense of it being like the embodied heart, right? Because the heart can be separated out from the body, or the emotions can be. Okay, so that's number one. Let's see if you can have that be more embodied. And secondly, if you do distinguish the postures from activities, then let that be the focus. You don't have to do it. Again, the suggestion is to find just some ways of cultivating mindfulness body. So I guess I'm giving two. Bring in that sense of the body in metta practice, and then if you want to focus on the body, do it with different activities.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Tom, have you tried to be conscious of the body when you're reading?
When I'm reading?
Mm-hmm.
I have, yeah.
And has that been easy or hard?
It's harder, yeah. It's harder. I've tried it with email on the computer. You know, I mean, these days the practice I do is a little bit more like an open awareness rather than, well, I have done focused mindfulness of the body with reading or with looking at things on the computer. It's, for me, it's advanced practice. Probably for most people it is. And so I would experiment with it some. It's easier, you know, you could see that it's easier when you're listening, right? That you can do that. I mean, again, the aim is partly to develop mindfulness of the body, but it's partly also to listen, almost listen with our bodies and hearts, not just with the cerebral or the mental aspect. That's, so it's not just about strengthening body awareness. There are other reasons, too, why it's important, right? So I would experiment some if you're interested, but again, I see it as a more advanced practice, so it could be more fruitful to put your energy elsewhere. But if you're pretty solid with mindfulness of the body elsewhere, then you can try it. I would try it for 3 minutes at a time, not very long. Yeah. Thanks. Hi.
Let's see if I can phrase this as a question. The thought is running through now as we're talking that there's a promise here, you know. Is that the point is really not to become a good breather or even a mindful breather.
Yeah.
That it leads somewhere.
Yeah.
Which is implicit, I think, but not explicit in, you know, these quotes. What do you think about that?
Yeah, this mindfulness is a means to an end. The end is always freedom, liberation, wisdom, living from the wise heart, however we talk about it. And mindfulness is one of our major tools. So, and so when we're mindful, mindfulness is almost a prerequisite for wisdom. You can't really be wise if you don't know what's happening, right? And so it's a core capacity for the path. I think all the practices we do are not an end in themselves, but they're means to an end. And the end is wisdom. And eventually, the practices themselves, being with the breath, strengthens the capacity so that maybe ultimately, I think where this all points is that ultimately we don't even need to spend so much time with the breath, because the mindfulness and concentration have been developed to a high degree, and they're just with us all the time. That being said, I had the sense the Buddha did hang out with mindfulness practice. He hung out with doing metta, you know, it seems from the text. So I don't know whether he was just doing it to, you know, be a good companion with other people practicing, but I have to think that it was there are ways that it's just a natural it's a natural state. I mean, I think it's one way of talking about it, and that these practices are, I don't know, whatever we want to say. I was going to use the word artificial. That's not really quite the right word, but they're
skillful means.
What? Skillful means. Yeah, they're skillful. Very good. They're skillful means that develop capacities which bring us towards an awakened quality. And in the awakened quality, we don't have to do the practices anymore because those capacities are stable. That's where we're going, right? And so the practice takes us there. And I think we've all probably had times where those natural capacities were there. We didn't have to work too hard and they were present. Maybe not for too long, but for a while, where you could just be present, have your heart open, listen to a friend in distress, be very present. These are all natural capacities, you know. It's like, I think that's important to know, that these are natural capacities which we develop through these practices. The first retreat I ever did, I was a student, and I had been interested in like altered states of consciousness, which some of you may have been interested in, maybe still are interested in. And so I was reading a lot of the literature on altered states, right? Those terms aren't used so much these days, but some people use them. Anyway, and so, and my first retreat, I was so impressed with how being present and mindful wasn't something artificial, but was like a natural awareness, a natural way of being. And I came up with the slogan, civilization is an altered state of consciousness. Right? Like default way of being, culturally habitual way of consciousness. That's what's artificial. That's what's altered, right? But the natural presence, open heart, fullness of life, that's our birthright, right? And so we're, in a way, doing these practices to come out of an alienated state, which is sad. But I think that's the truth, yeah. So that gets at it some, yeah.
Can you say something about skillful means for being mindful at times when it seems extremely difficult? I've had a period of trauma being released in my nervous system and really disrupting sleep.
Yeah.
And when sleep's disrupted in me for a long enough time, I feel less and less capable of being a witness. I feel sort of immersed in something.
Yeah.
So what?
That's an important point, and really thank you for asking that, because it's something that's been important for me that I didn't bring out this evening yet. And so thank you. At times, mindfulness of the body is accessible. At times, mindfulness of the body is not accessible. You know, maybe if we're really, really activated, it doesn't have to be trauma, it can be trauma, but we're really, really activated and maybe triggered. People use sometimes words like there's just the body is very, very activated, and there is a threshold beyond which we can't really be mindful. So one of the important questions to be asked if you're trying to be mindful of the body is my actual current state in a workable range where I can be mindful? And most of what we've been talking about so far, it most likely would be. If you're just listening here, probably you could be mindful of your body without a problem. For some people, especially when they begin meditation, to ask people to be mindful of their body is not so skillful, right? Where you need to give qualifications that if someone has a background of trauma, being aware of the body may take them into the trauma. If they have unresolved trauma in their body, someone who maybe has some trauma related to the breath, maybe a history of asthma, you ask someone to be with the breath, it's not so skillful. I've met people, because now I went through trauma training in somatic experiencing, and we had a very interesting group of people where it was a 3-year training, and we had a group of about 6 or 8 people who were meditation teachers going through the training. We would have lunches together and talk about these issues. And we would talk about how to give instructions, and I changed my, like many of us, I changed my instructions, and I didn't simply say be aware of the breath. I say if the breath is available, if any way the breath is not emotionally neutral, then use something else. And I've met people who were having traumatic experience on retreat, the teachers didn't know it, And they just said, stay with it, which they could not do. And they just hung out and re-traumatized themselves at retreats. Not helpful, not skillful. So it's more knowledge now. So generally, it would be to gauge the level of activation. And if the level of activation is beyond that which you can be mindful of, then find ways to deactivate. That'd be the basic instruction. And that you can only be mindful of trauma within it when it's in a range where the level of activation is not too high. And ideally, you never want to get to the place where it's too high, you know, in working with trauma. So that's, is that a beginning?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's a beginning to the, so it is a question. And generally, this would be the case if, I mean, it's the case also with really difficult emotions where you're trying to be mindful of them, but you want to, if something is strong and difficult, try to make a gauge. What's the degree of challenge or difficulty on a scale of 1 to 10? And if it's in the 8s or 9s or 10s, it's probably beyond your capacity for mindfulness. Could be a really difficult emotion as well, related to the body experience. So I want to really assess that and know that mindfulness is not available for us in every moment. It is not a every moment, every experience practice. It's only when it's workable. And when we're in an experience where we're a little bit overwhelmed, we want other practices that bring us back to balance. It could be a variety of those kind of practices, you know, doing something physical, you know, if you've worked with trauma, you know exercises that you can do. Grounding, keeping your eyes open, orienting, looking, being with something really, really pleasant. Those are some core, looking around, you know. It comes up in retreats sometimes. People go into traumatic places, yeah. Have to work with that.